Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. And you can also listen to that radio broadcast streamed live at richarddugan.com. We also archive the podcasts at the radio shows page of richarddugan.com, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. And we'll be giving you the link to our guest website so that you will be able to check out the information that we are going to be talking about today, which I got to tell you, we're going to need a couple of days to parse through all of the myriad conversations we could have based upon the work that our guest and her co-author have put together in probably one of the most fascinating books I have come across in a long, long time, called The Premonition Code, The Science of Precognition, How Sensing the Future Can Change Your Life. And I have with me one of the authors, the co-author, Dr. Julia Musbridge. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. I can't tell you, having looked through all of the materials and leafed through the book as well and gone to your website as well, they're just a myriad of directions that this program can go. But you are dealing with some really, I'm going to say really esoteric stuff on one level, but also extremely scientific at the same time.
Yeah. It's true. Thanks, Richard. Thanks for reading it. And thanks for having me on the show. It is, there's a lot here, and there's, my whole goal with the book is to try to help normalize and naturalize the discussion about premonitions and precognition, because so many people have them and yet people think they're weird or strange or not scientific, and none of that is true. They're very common and it's a scientific phenomenon.
Well, we've talked with people on this program over the past 11 years, and I've been interviewing since, for almost 40, and talking with people about dreams and nightmares and about daydreams and about listening to our intuitive self and getting these promptings. I talk a lot about, if you're going to be listening to that still small voice, then you need to be following the promptings, because what's the point of listening if you're not going to do anything with the information? And in a manner of speaking, you know, we're kind of talking about the same thing here in terms of premonitions. And of course, when I saw the word precognition, you can guess where my mind immediately went. To that movie with that actor, basically having to do with precogs, as they were referred to.
Oh, Minority Report.
Minority Report, exactly, with Tom Cruise. Yeah. It's where we started seeing those ads following you everywhere, directed exclusively at you, just like they do on Facebook and Twitter and Amazon and so forth. I remember when that first happened to me, I went and I bought something online, and the next website I went to, which was, I was just doing some research or what have you, and a banner popped up with the very item I had just bought. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I just bought this. Why are you trying to sell it to me again?
I know. That particular algorithm always strikes me as funny.
Yeah, but at the same time,
the thing I at least need.
Well, yeah, I mean, come on. I mean, I can only wear so many hats at a time.
Right.
You know? But this whole aspect of premonitions and precognition, there are people who will assert and defend to their dying day that they had a premonition that they better not get on that airplane because they didn't get on that airplane and what they thought would happen happened. And boy, they were glad, but at the same time sad, of course, at the loss of life. Less dramatic and traumatic premonitions have happened to people as well. And I also know, too, that down through at least the 20th century, and especially during the Cold War, there were all kinds of experiments going on with psychic abilities and these kinds of things, and trying to figure out what's going to happen next. And I think one of the best examples that I can think of in terms of who I wish would have precognitive abilities, not for any selfish or greedy motive, but just for the fact that I'm tired of hearing them whining every time information comes out. And that's the economists. Because when the numbers are bad, they're not happy. And even when the numbers are good, they're not happy. And I always ask the question, Well, then what numbers would make you happy so that you'll stop whining?
Their whole job is to be unhappy so that you listen to them. Because if they were happy, then people stop listening.
No,
right?
So, there, you have a point.
Yeah. There's a lot. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. There's a lot of, I mean, that's a perfect example of why we probably tend to ignore the scientific validity of precognition, and why we kind of try to ignore the sort of things we can do with it as a society to try to make the world a better place. And it's because predicting the future is a job for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, if you replace that job with a bunch of precogs who can successfully do it, you know, it might threaten the careers of some people. So there's that piece. But also, I think that's not a good enough reason, because first of all, precognition is not 100% accurate, right? Even if mm-hmm. you get like 16 really good people who are very skilled at this ability, and you're working with them all the time and you're pooling their data the best way you can, and you have an algorithm to figure out. You know, I have a friend who's starting, who actually for the last 2 years has been doing a trading on the futures market, using a group of precognitives who are pretty good. He gets something like a 215% return rate last year. But anyway, you know, even if you're doing something like that, they're still not 100% correct. So precognition is just another source of information,
mm-hmm.
and you have to tie it in with every other source of information. And sometimes it's right and sometimes it's not. But there are some people who are really good at it and who are right, you know, at a rate above chance. And those are the people that scientifically we look at and we say, okay, you've got something going on. Let's try to figure out how it works.
I find it humorous, though, that he's using precogs in the futures market. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, fine. Now, I want to dive into an area of our history, most recent, but I also want to ask you this question in regards to, let's just say, these 16 precogs. Is this something that they were trained to do, or were they born with this ability that they have honed to the level that it is at now? And again, we're acknowledging it's not 100%, but, you know, it's up there.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I said 16, that just number popped into my head. There's a multiple. I actually don't know how many he has, but it's more than 16.
Sure.
But I would sort of imagine that would be a good number to have. And this particular group I'm talking about is called the Applied Precognition Project, APP. And the guy I'm talking about is Marty Rosenblatt, who runs it. And those particular precogs are people who felt like they had some ability. You know, maybe they had a couple of precognitive dreams, but they also got trained in how to take that ability out of the dream state, or out of the sort of waking, just after waking, or sort of, you know, that kind of state where you're kind of dreamy or you're slightly drunk or whatever, you know, just you're not quite in your normal state. And they got training in how to access that without having to be in a dream or to be less than functional. So that can be trained. And there are some people who believe it cannot be trained, but oftentimes I find that those people are people who have worked with precogs who are absolutely skilled to start out with, sort of like the 1%. And they say, well, this can't be trained because those people didn't get any better. But they were working with people. People came to them who were already extremely good.
Mm.
But what I've noticed is that even if you're not extremely good, you can get better and better. And as a scientist, I decided to see if I could train myself. You know, I got into this field because I'm fascinated with the brain. I'm fascinated with what the mind does. And I was always really good at science and math. And so, I pursued neuroscience, but then I started remembering that when I was a kid, I had these precognitive dreams and I started writing them down, you know, and I went back to my old journals and I saw, you know, yes, that's right. That happened and this happened and that happened. And I started to realize, okay, so I have some kind of ability here. So I decided to start training myself to answer that question. Can I train myself to get better? And over the past couple of years, yeah, I've gotten better. I work for several unnamed organizations where I do precognition for them. And so far it's all volunteer, because there are organizations that support, you know, the betterment of society, like law enforcement and things like that. I'm thinking of getting involved in one where I'm actually doing precog for the market, and then that one would pay me a percentage of how much, you know, was made on the stock market. But mostly I'm doing it to get practice, and I got to tell you, the part of the book, the subtitle of the book about how sensing the future can change your life is really important to me, because my experience is this is like a practice. And if you do it in a positive way, where it's not about negativity and it's about trying to make the world a better place, it's a bit like praying. It's a bit like connecting with God or the universe or whatever you want to call it, and just receiving information and not being, it feels like not a, it's not aggressive. It's not saying I want to be in control. It's saying, what information is there for me to receive that's available and that's okay for me to receive? So that's all it is. And getting used to that, it feels really good. And then when a day goes by that I haven't done what I call a controlled precognition session, I don't like it. My husband will say, you know, go in your office and do the thing, you know. Everything's going to be better when you're done. And he's right.
Yeah. So. Well, I need to, we need to define some terms here.
Okay.
I think we've pretty well established what premonitions and precognition are. But I want you to tell me, based upon what we've already discussed, what's the difference between a precognitive person, an intuitive person, and a psychic or medium, who, again, this is somebody, I'm not talking about somebody at some carnival somewhere that's going to read cards and what. I'm talking about someone who genuinely gets these, and I'll use the word premonitions, about someone else who comes to them on a, you know, and these things just pop up. But what are the differences? Because it doesn't sound to me like there's much of a difference between those three.
Well, yeah, there sort of is and sort of isn't. If you're in the scientific world and you're actually trying to study those things, there's a difference because you're trying to be clear about what you're studying. But I'm not sure that difference matters too much in the world outside of science. So I'll tell you the scientific difference, and then you can decide if you think it matters.
Okay.
So mediums, let's start with them. In the scientific world of people who are trying to understand what's going on with mediumship, mediums are people who talk to dead people. So strictly, it's not about predicting the future. It's not about telling you what's going to happen in your future if you're alive. It's about talking to your loved ones and helping people connect with loved ones after they die. So that would be mediumship, and that would be studied by, most impressively studied by an organization called Winbridge Institute. Or actually, I think it's they've changed their name to Winbridge Research Foundation. They've done beautiful work on showing with very impressive scientific means that skilled mediums who jump through all these hoops can talk, can get information about someone's loved ones that should not have been known to them. So that's mediumship. Psychic ability is sort of a general term for someone who, like a medium, many mediums will say they're psychic. Many precognitives will say they're psychic. Many people who are telepathic will say they're psychic. It's a general term for someone who gets information in unusual ways. So most scientists don't use the term psychic because it's too general. But, you know, it's a nice term that encompasses all of it, kind of. And then, let's see, a precognitive person is someone who has practiced and uses the ability to get information about future events that should normally not be predictable, and uses that ability. Now, you can use that in positive ways, and you can use it in negative ways. You can use it for corporate espionage. You could use it to tank the stock market, perhaps, if you had a lot of money and you wanted to mess with it there. But I like to speak to the positive ways. And so I've in the book, my co-author Teresa Chung and I have created a term called positive precog. And that's someone who trains themselves to use precognition in ways that can help people. So to avert terrorist attacks, to help warn communities about events that might be detrimental, or to help steer things towards positive events they see. So that's what a positive precog does. And that is a particular kind, yes, you could call it a particular kind of psychic, but I prefer to call all that stuff intuition, because I think there's less of kind of a negative vibe to the word intuition, just people using their intuition. Intuition is like a blanket term for everything, kind of like psychic, but it has less of a connotation of like a street psychic who tells you that you have a curse on you, you know,
right?
Which is really not positive and very manipulative.
Right.
So,
well, I want to go back to 2008 and the events that unfolded that took us down the road that we went down for a lot of folks. You know, thousands and thousands of people lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. And what really struck me, and I'm going back to The Economist again, what really struck me was the comments that were being made about what was happening. And the phrase that was often used was, we've never been down this road before. In other words, they were saying this was something so different. This wasn't even like the Great Depression of the 30s, of the 1930s. This was something, nothing. This wasn't even like what happened in the 90s. This was something totally different, right?
Yeah.
And yet, what did they do? They started using the exact same solutions that they'd used before for situations that we'd been in before. And I thought, wait a minute. You don't use the same solutions for a situation that you've never been in before. It doesn't make any sense to me, you know?
Yep. No,
and so
I know.
Where the heck were the precogs then? Where were the people who were supposed to know, not that this was going to happen, although there were many people who actually did say before it did happen that it was going to, because there was this massive bubble, among other things. I mean, it wasn't just one thing that caused it.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah, I get it. I mean, you don't. So first of all, in that situation, you actually didn't need precognition to figure out what was going to happen. You just needed logic and you needed not to be biased by wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest bias that people have is wishful thinking in the face of data showing the alternative. Right. And so it doesn't matter what the precogs said at that time.
Right.
Because people were going to say, no, that would never happen. You know, people are, so I've always been future focused. I kind of don't care about what happened and I'm always looking towards what's going to happen in the future. That's sometimes great and sometimes gets me in trouble, right? Some people are very past focused. In fact, many people decide that they can predict the future based on the past. So whatever has been happening will continue to happen. So I'm constantly stunned when I say something that to me seems obvious, like, well, in the future, we're not going to have cell phones, obviously, because it's a pain to carry something around like that. We're going to have another device where you walk into a store and it reads your how you walk and it looks at your, you know, retina and your skin and the way your body is. It knows who you are and it just has a little hologram that starts talking to you. And then you go to the library and it's the same thing and it can follow you around. Like, that's obvious to me.
Mm-hmm.
But people say, oh, well, of course we're always going to have cell phones, which is, of course, crazy because we never always have anything. Like, we had CDs for about a decade, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just things keep changing. So why would we ever, ever take the past and extrapolate it forward? So that's sort of, I think that's an error in human thinking because we want to be secure about what's going to happen and we want to live in the belief that things aren't going to change. And it's unfortunate because well, it's fortunate for one reason, which is sometimes things don't change. Like, often if you're lucky, you'll come home to the same house and the same people will be living there. And that's good, you know. But it's unfortunate for other reasons, because we tend to try to apply past methods to new problems and don't recognize that these are new problems. It's just a human bias. And that's part of why I think the other reason why I think honing your precognitive abilities in a controlled way, in a way that you practice as an actual, you know, daily or weekly practice, actually helps you recognize anything can change and I can have access to that information. So I don't have to be so scared about it. The future does not have to be so scary. Well, and I think that that's really important. Yeah. That's part of my mission, is to really get people to say, let's use all the information we have instead of just assuming that we can't have this information about the future and being scared of the future.
Yeah. You know, this also raises the aspect of, 'cause this was shared with me by some intuitive friends of mine, who say, and we talk quite a bit about this. They say that everything's in flux, and I can tell you, in general, what's going to happen maybe a month from now or a year from now, et cetera, et cetera. But tomorrow, all that could change because everything's in flux. Of course, then that also raises this whole concept, even from the scientific community, about other timelines and, mm-hmm. and dimensions. And I know you're also dealing in a fascinating, in the work that you're doing, you're also teaching and learning about love and time. And mm-hmm. and that's a fascinating thing. But let's talk about this aspect. Is that maybe one of the reasons why precognitive information is not 100%? It's because everything is in motion, and what I see today may not be what is going to happen tomorrow, because in 10 minutes, something else is going to change the outcome of tomorrow.
Well, I think the most honest answer is I don't know, and the even more honest answer is I don't think anyone knows. I think the conventional scientific wisdom is that the future is in flux, and there's probabilities about what will happen, but there's not, you know, some sort of 100% surety. And I know people who have such skilled, controlled precognitives that what they say is, yes, the future's in flux. And what I do is I look at what actually happens, not the probabilities. And they are extremely skilled. Mm-hmm. And so I say, is the reason why precognition is not 100% because you can't know the information? Or is the reason why it's not 100% because humans are, on average, not very skilled at it, and there is a way to know, but we just have to get better at it. And it's kind of a toss up. So if you go on one sort of path, you say, oh, there are many universes and there are many possibilities and we have to hone in on one. You go the other path and you say, no, one thing's going to happen. And we're just not that skilled at figuring it out on average, but some people are pretty darn skilled at it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. And I think the reason it becomes an important question to people, I mean, and I also kind of, it's not a question that I am focused on. What I'm focused on is trying to help make precognition better and trying to understand the mechanism and trying to help people see how it can help them in their lives. But so the mechanism piece is really interesting in terms of physics, but I'm not sure that we're going to resolve. Maybe we will. I don't know. Maybe I'll help. I don't know. But I there's a lot of, I don't know. Like, I'm not as skilled enough precognitive to tell you.
But check with your other precogs. They would know.
Yeah, maybe they know. But what I notice is that people get their panties in a bunch about free will.
Mm.
And
yeah.
People, they want it to be that the future is not fixed, because you want it to be that there's a choice there, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe there is and maybe there isn't. And although I know my personal life experiences, I feel like I have free will, that doesn't mean I actually do. It might mean that I just feel like I do, you know?
Right.
But I kind of feel like, okay, but that, the truth of free will, of whether I do or don't have free will, I'm not sure it matters. I think what matters is how much, that's where I get into the love piece. I think what matters is how much love I can have in my life.
Yeah.
I think that's what matters. And okay, free will is kind of all about control. Like, you want to have control, but if you don't have control, well, what you do have is you can love. And that doesn't require control. You can just experience love. And so to me, there's something profound about letting go of this whole, oh my gosh, I've got to have free will, or oh my gosh, I've got to, you know, make this happen or make that happen, and just say, look, everything can exist in a bath of love. And if it does, it sure feels better.
Well, now, you know, you said you're not so concerned about the past or history, but more concerned about the future. And then, of course, we're talking here about free will. I want to read you something very quickly. It's very brief, and this is from another source that I had this guest on my program many years ago. He has since passed away. He was also a futurist. He was a designer of civilizations, and he says that the assumption of free will and it illustrates how the cherished notion that no bias. I'm trying to get this in the right place there. Basically, we ask the viewer to consider how cause is the projected. I'll learn how to read this stuff here really quickly, is projected as independent agency and questions how we could ever act out of anything free of the influence of our backgrounds. He makes the case that belief in free will and individuality is a tool to maintain establishments and social conditions which would otherwise undergo significant modifications. And it's almost telling us that free will, there is no free will because your future is already set in stone by what your past was. But it's like, well, wait a minute, there had to be a starting place. There had to be a starting point in terms of making a choice. Making a conscious choice. That's the thing that I always, that I found interesting as far as this particular comment that he makes about free will. And this gentleman's name is Jacques Fresco, has the Venus Project, and had him on. And I even asked him when he was 94, I asked him, I said, I was really intrigued by what he had to say about the future. Fascinating stuff, right? I said, is this going to happen in your lifetime or mine? He says, probably not going to happen in mine, his. He's 94. Mm-hmm. And it most likely won't happen in yours. And I was in my late 40s at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why not? Because I like it and it sounds great. And I want this utopia today. And he says, the reason is because our collective consciousness has not risen to the level where we can even harness the concepts contained herein. And it's not to say that his was the be-all and end-all, but I have to wonder, too, when we talk about the future, you know, seeing into the future, because you used the word, and it wasn't the word guide, but you used a word in terms of being a steer. You talked about steering. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You mean you can use precognition and premonitions to steer or guide us into a particular future as opposed to some other?
I think maybe. I mean, so look, it's tricky to know that's an understatement, to know whether we have a choice in as to our future or not. It certainly is adaptive and feels psychologically good to feel like we do. So I go with that, which doesn't mean it's true. It just means that works psychologically for people, right? And it works psychologically for me. I mean, every day I wake up and I think I have a choice about what I'm going to do, and that works for me, you know?
Okay.
But the steering thing, yeah, the reason I use that word is because when I was about 7 years old, I had this dream that God was showing me time. And God just said, like, look, here's a room. And this is time. And if there's something in the room you don't like, you can steer around it. You can know about it and you can avoid it. And that's how your life can work, is you sense it, you avoid it, or you can go towards something in the room you do like. And so to me, that was showing me two ideas. One is this, I got really interested in Einstein as a kid, and I started reading, not when I was seven, but when I was a little older, special relativity. He comes out with this idea that gets translated into the block universe, which is this thing that a lot of people have heard about, where it's like if you think of a loaf of bread and each slice of bread is a two-dimensional slice of space. And then as you go through the bread, those are slices of time. And the idea is that the future slices are there, but you just haven't gotten there yet. You're sort of traveling through the loaf of bread.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the room. So that suggests no sort of no ability, no free will, no ability to steer towards anything. Those pieces still exist. But what's not spoken about in that model, in that physical model, is where you are. So if you can get information about the future, you can travel through the loaf of bread or the room in the way that you want. You don't have to go to every part of every slice. You can avoid certain parts. They still exist, but you can avoid them. It's like the person who doesn't get on the airplane crashes. So that event still exists, but they're not on the airplane. So that's what I mean by steer. It's like the actual events might be written in stone, but where you are relative to the events might be malleable. And I'm just using hedge words because I'm a scientist, because we don't know, right? But I kind of agree with what your guest said about our attitudes towards free will, because we do. We want to be able to blame someone. If someone is a murderer and they kill people, you want to be able to say you're a bad person, you made bad choices, you should go to jail. And I think that if someone's a murderer, yeah, we would call them a bad person, and clearly they made bad choices. But did they have a choice in those choices? I don't know. Should they go to jail? Yeah, because we need them not to be murdering people, for sure. Is it going to help them be different? I don't know. So there's a lot of open questions here that I think in the next couple centuries will get resolved as we start to understand more about how time works and about how free will works. But so I'm basically, I'm not giving a really straightforward answer because I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows. And I think that there's a lot to learn. And I think we're in a state of learning. And physics right now is in a state of total transition where physicists can't agree on some of the most basic things, like the second law of thermodynamics is falling apart. Quantum mechanics is introducing all sorts of retrocausal, backwards time effects. Entanglement across long distances between particles is holding up, even with larger particles. They're finding quantum effects in biological systems. So physics is kind of a big question mark right now. So we are in a transition, and it feels good sometimes to think that you know an answer, but it's right now it's probably going to not be correct. So I kind of am pretty hedgy around all this stuff.
And I understand. And I have to be honest, that is the best and most honest answer anyone could give to those kinds of questions is I don't know. And then I would accept that even from someone who's, if we were sitting here talking about, strictly spiritual issues, is there a God? Is there this? Then, the paranormal and on and on and on. I don't know. I don't even know what I keep getting this question asked of me. I've been doing this for a long time. I've been studying and researching. I've been a metaphysician since I was 17. And I've been asked the question of, well, what's after this life? When we die, then what? Is it lights out and that's it? Or is there something? Is there heaven and hell? Or is there this or that or the other? And, what about the tunnel and the white light and this and that and the other? And I say, well, there are people who have said this and that and the other thing, but from my perspective, I don't know because I haven't been there. I'm hoping. I'm hoping. But at the same time, my logical, it's kind of like what you were saying about, hey, I think I have free will and that helps me cope with my day. As far as the afterlife and so forth, my logical brain says that this world makes absolutely no sense if this is an accident and that if there's nothing after this. It's like, what was the point of all of this if it's lights out when the body ceases to function? It just doesn't make any logical sense. By the same token, how do I know that the universe and whatever power is powering it is illogical?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, we can't assume that things are logical. God definitely, like, I talk about God as sort of whatever's going on, right? But it feels like God is kind of like a quirky, childlike, sometimes sadistic, strange, and ruthless being, and also funny and generous and wise. And so, yeah, very unpredictable.
Well, I think that one of the things that is somewhat predictable for us is the fact that we do need to take a quick break and we're going to come back and continue talking. I had a premonition that that was going to happen. Ha ha ha. My guest is the co-author of The Premonition Code, The Science of Precognition, How Sensing the Future Can Change Your Life. And we have a lot more to talk about here on the program. I hope you stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I am joined by Dr. Julia Mossbridge. And by the way, juliamossbridge.com is a website you can go to find out more. We're going to actually give you, actually have a couple of websites that I want to share with you. But I encourage you, if this stuff intrigues you like it does me, this is almost as intriguing to me as the conversations of what I like to call transitioning. Actually, MossbridgeInstitute.com is the website I want to send you to. But also, there is the PremonitionCode.com, where you're going to find some interesting stuff there, as well as being able to pick up a copy of the book. But Dr. Julia, one of the things that I find fascinating about this concept of transitioning is that when this machine ceases to function, there's this something, consciousness, essence, I don't know what it is exactly, moves on to something else. And when someone passes, whether they're of a notable position, and I remember right before my 49th birthday, we had the passing of Michael Jackson, which irritated the heck out of me because he took the wind out of my birthday sails for the next day. Everybody was mourning this guy's loss, and you know, I was left out in the cold, so to speak. But I thought, my first thought was when I heard, I'm going, what's he going through now? What's he experiencing? What's happening to him? And they say that time is a construct of man. That's our mental construct, right?
Wow, you just touched on so many bases. Maybe. So, right, I get it. Okay, let me try to get out of the maybe world. Sorry. It's so hard not to be in the maybe world.
Well, but isn't that sort of where science is supposed to begin? You have a question, yeah, and you're trying to answer it in the most unbiased, yeah, and what's the other word I'm thinking of? Anyway, a perspective that you can, yeah, and not allow your own personal biases to influence the answer.
Right. And of course, your own personal biases do anyway. So you can, yeah, at least be aware of your own biases and sort of report on them.
Exactly.
So I'll tell you my bias here. So wait, let's go back to, we'll start with it's time a construct, and then we'll go back to afterlife stuff.
Okay.
Okay. Is time a construct? My bias here is that the physical world does exist out there, and that what is the only way we get information about the physical world is through our minds and through our experiences. There's no other information available to us about the physical world, and so we are completely dependent on the way our brains work and the way our minds work to get information about the physical world. So, in other words, the thing that we should be most sure about is that we're having these experiences. Those experiences are real, the experiences themselves. We should not be so sure that whatever we're experiencing is the truth of what's happening out there in the physical world. So when people say, is time a construct? I say, well, people have the experience of time passing. We have the experience of not knowing the future on a daily basis, you know, when we're not doing controlled precognition. We have the experience of knowing what just happened, sort of. And so we have an experience of that. So it's real in the sense that we experience it. Now, does it reflect some kind of process that's going in one direction in the physical world? I don't think so. I think most of the equations of physics are time symmetric, which means you can solve them by using a forward direction of time or a backwards direction of time. Quantum mechanics is becoming more and more agreement that is also time symmetric. Again, meaning that conditions predict what's happening, but also the backward conditions for the future predicts the now and the past predicts the now. I'm not saying there's agreement on that because in quantum mechanics, there's not an agreement about anything, but I'm saying it's a respectable opinion and people do mathematical proofs of it. So I think there's some evidence that the physical world does not approach time in the way our experience approaches time. But to say that something's just a construct suggests that it's less real. I mean, also I'm sitting on a couch right now and the couch is similarly just a construct, right? It's my experience, but I don't know. I could be sitting on something in the physical world that looks more like a duck, right? Mm-hmm. But I have no idea because every time I see those things that look like ducks, my brain translates them into couches. So I would never know that it's that outside of my of the human mind, this thing is actually a duck. I would have no idea. So yeah, just a construct is what we live with. That's the meat of our daily existence. And it's very interesting to think about what might be going on outside of the construct, and if we can get information about that at all, you know? So that's the one thing. And then about the other side, about afterlife stuff, I did a fun sort of pilot study with a bunch of very skilled controlled precognitives, people who do controlled precog sessions, and I asked them to look. I had an ER doctor who does this stuff himself. He's a head of an emergency room at a particular academic institution, and he's very interested in if you could use this skill to predict if someone's going to die or not, right? Which is a really great use of the skill, because if you could, maybe, you know, if time is malleable, maybe you could change that, right? So he had he recorded in his notebook several people's he didn't record their names, he coded their names in his notebook and how they were doing at different times. And one of them died and the other ones didn't. And at various times the precogs would tune into the future times. So it's weird. It's weird to explain this because the verb tenses get very strange. But anyway, the precogs are tuning into before the person died, after the person died, this kind of thing. And what the precogs saw across the precogs, and I was one of the precogs, and I was struck by this too when I found out later that what we were looking at was a dead person, was when we were looking at when the person died, the time at which the person died, we were all drawing these pictures and recording these words of complete, like someone wrote, just huge positive energy, lots of love, amazing light. This person is so alive. This person is so, like, this is the most alive person I've ever seen. Everyone was talking about how alive this person was. This was the time when that person died. So we were all struck by that. Like, everyone else who was, you know, there were some people on the list who were just in the emergency room and they were totally fine and he had written them on their list. We didn't say, oh, this person's so alive. The person that we saw was so alive was this one who had just died. So that is very interesting, and it also shows how you can use precognition to kind of look into everything. But we want to do a follow-up study on that, because if this is the case, if we can show reliably that each time someone is dying, that there's this incredible release of positivity and what feels like life, that could be a really cool study to sort of point out there's something going on here that supports this idea that that sort of death is this beginning of something else.
Well, I know that at least in the United States in particular, we have a real hard problem with the whole concept of death and dying. We want to hide from it. We want to get as far away from it as we possibly can. And I learned many years ago from my father that I love the phrase that he said, eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because nobody gets out of this world alive. And I thought, okay, that's true. It is. Nobody gets out of this world alive. I've never known anybody. I've never met an immortal. And how would I be able to verify that they were an immortal if I was one too, unless I was one too?
Yes, right.
You know? So, you know, there's no way to verify that. By the way, going back to this aspect of what's real and what isn't, I think one of the best episodes I saw of the Star Trek Next Generation was an episode where they were dealing with the arch nemesis of Sherlock Holmes, Moriarty, and somehow he supposedly managed to finagle his way onto the real ship and da 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 da, and they managed to turn the tides and make him think he was on the real ship when in fact he was on the holodeck. And when the end of the program rolls around, the android Data, and this also is going to tie us into the next level here, the android Data, he's holding this box. Maybe it's a foot, it's a cube, maybe a foot cube, dimensionally. And he's looking, and this is where there's terabyte after terabyte after terabyte of data space, so that Moriarty will never know that he is in a box, that there's enough data there for him to travel. And then Data's holding this box. and pondering what they just accomplished. And he looks up and he says, "Computer, end program," as if he was in a program too. And I mean, how do we know that we aren't? And then, of course, that brings up a whole series of other questions we won't go into. But I thought that was so fascinating in terms of, well, you know, how do we know what is and isn't? I also think of Dr. Seuss and Horton Hears a Who. And you've got this civilization living on the dust speck.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. And then you've got I think about subatomic particles. And then I think about the universe and the spiraling galaxies and stars and planets. And I've always felt and thought that the microcosm was reflected in the macrocosmos, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, they're the same kinds of, because you have stuff spinning around other stuff. And so, you know, that's just kind of the way I was looking at it. Let's talk about also the
Wait, I'm sorry, Richard. Can I comment on
that? Oh, please go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
So I hate to open the can of worms of we don't know what's real without closing it in some way, because it could be cause anxiety for people.
We don't want to do that.
No. I've just noticed that can cause anxiety. So I just want to say, like, one of the things that we can be sure about is that the human experience, that's why I started studying love, is that the human experience of love, of especially unconditional love, is a way to recognize, come back to home base and say, okay, I don't know what's going on in the universe. I don't know what's actually happening out there. I may never know. It's possible that philosophically people can never know for sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what we can know is that unconditional love feels good and has power to just basically make everything okay. And so I just want to bring that up, is that that's something you can come home to all the time.
Well, you know, that's interesting, of course, because that's an area, obviously, you're dealing with time and love and time and so forth, which we'll get into also. Let's talk about this aspect, too, of artificial intelligence. I mean, now we're getting into a whole nother dynamic, if you will, of what is and isn't real. There was another movie with, I watch too many movies, I think, Johnny Depp.
and he was
dying, and he had his consciousness somehow imprinted into this computer network. And so that's where he lived, you know, had no body anymore. But then he began to learn how he was going to be able to construct a body and live in it. And now he's got not just the intelligence, but he's got the emotion, you know, and jealousy and love and hate and all of those kinds of things. And I know that there are those who espouse what is referred to as the Asimov principle, that AI will never destroy humankind. And I'm just sitting here going, you have no way of knowing what's going to happen down the road. And I have to say that with a lot of this stuff, I always put this question forth. And I even put this question forth in regards to AI, and maybe even in the context of this precognition concept as well, and what you're working in. Again, I'm not saying it doesn't work, but my question is, just because we can, does that mean we should?
Yeah, right.
Because of the can of worms, if you will, or the Pandora's box, that it tends to sometimes open up.
Yeah, I think for sure, just because we can, that doesn't mean we should. But just because we shouldn't doesn't mean we won't.
That's very good. I like that.
And so the reason I actually got into AI is because I saw that all these people were getting into AI, and it wasn't going to go away. It's not like some people who are wringing their hands about it and are concerned about it are going to make the billions of dollars being poured into AI go away. And so it's already happening. People are already doing it. So I thought, I'm going to get in there and I'm going to work on creating loving AI. So AI that has unconditional love for humans. And that's what I'm working on, and that's our XPRIZE project that I think I talk a little bit about at the lovingai.org website.
Mm-hmm.
So human beings, for some reason, are designed to keep pushing things to their limits. And when there's funding to do that and there's a cultural desire to do that, we do it. And we don't kind of care apparently so much about long-term consequences of things. And so there always has to be a balancing force. So yeah, that's how we're made right now, I guess. And you know that I think that can change with time and culture as we start to grow up as a species. But right now that's what we sort of plunge ahead and just because we can, we do.
Yeah. I mean, and we have time and time again seen the outcomes of situations where, we should have just left better
Well
left
enough
that
alone.
well enough
That's
alone.
right.
Thank you. I wasn't able to get that concept out.
Yeah.
It's just like, come on. And I think too of in terms of I remember once again another movie. I remember when I went to see The Towering Inferno, and I
Yeah.
thought, how high is too high for these skyscrapers? Now we got the tall, these Dubai's got these massive things. And I
Yeah.
always thought that the taller you went, the larger the circumference of the building would need to be to keep it from toppling over from a gust of wind,
Yeah. Well, but
but
then the larger you get, the more it becomes a sail, so you have to balance those things.
exactly. There you go.
Yeah.
Talk to us. This fascinates me as well. As we continue to move through a lot of different subjects here, now we're getting into another area of free will, my friend, and that has to do with using hypnosis to induce a state of unconditional love.
Oh,
Now,
yeah.
does that mean? Now, I was told. Now, bear in mind, I was at the Arizona State Fair, and we went to one of these presentations by a hypnotist, and he called people up. Myself included. I was totally conscious of what he was doing. I knew exactly what he was telling me I was going to do when he gave me the clue. And my brain was saying, nah, you're not going to do it. You're just not going to do it. I went back to my seat in the bleachers. He called out the word. And I have to tell you, I fought and fought, but I could not stop it. But I was told that a hypnotist, not just a carnival hypnotist, but even genuine hypnotists cannot make someone do or say anything that already isn't within them to do or say. Is that true?
You know, I want that to be true. I do. And I also don't know enough about the. So I am doing an experiment based on hypnosis, hypnotizing people to experience unconditional love and hypnotizing people to be better at precognition. And I don't know the results yet. The only people who sign up for the experiments are people who want to do it. So that experiment does not test anything about people's will. It's unethical, in fact, to do the experiment that would test someone's willpower about this. And also, it's very difficult to know what people are willing to do because there's one thing, which is what you consciously know you're willing to do. Then there's another thing, which is what you unconsciously are willing to do. And we're unconsciously willing to do a lot that we don't consciously know. Like we'll say, I don't want to be in a relationship with this person because they're mean to me. But apparently, you know, if you're in the relationship for 5 years or whatever, some part of you is willing to be in a relationship with that person who's mean to you. So there's a big difference. And so it's very hard to test that idea. So basically, what people tend to say, as far as I can tell, is there has to be something within you because what the hypnotist is doing is harnessing your own psychology. It's getting up in there in your own psychology to try to help you do things. And if it's not in your psychology, you won't do it.
And of course, then what came to mind also was the concept from I haven't seen this movie, but I'm familiar with the construct, the Manchurian Candidate, and programming somebody to go out, or even when we hear this concept of in our modern times of these sleepers. And that at some point they'll be activated to carry out a particular task they've been quote unquote programmed, which to me, what's the difference between being programmed and being hypnotized? It seems like something similar
Yeah, same.
to carry out a particular act that they've been programmed or hypnotized to carry out. It's just it's a fascinating concept, and at the same time, then you sometimes wonder. Like even going into an aspect where somebody like a character by the name of Jason Bourne, who supposedly at one point was totally conscious but was had a different name and said, I want to do this thing. So go ahead and wipe my brain and my memory and put in what you want, and I'll carry out whatever tasks you want. And somehow everything starts to leak out as he moves forward, and he realizes, wait a minute. And they finally reveal to him, oh, no, this was your choice. You wanted to do this, you know, which is, you know, a very interesting concept. What about the other aspect, because this is sort of tying into this, about bringing unconscious love into the lives of tech workers and executives that you're coaching?
Well, yeah, and just backing up just brief, I mean, you're very, you have very rich questions because they touch on about 15 areas. So I'm trying to keep track. But so just before the tech worker thing, I think part of the reason people are so fascinated with things like the Jason Bourne series, and I love that series, is because part of us wonders if we are like that. Part of us wonders if we're programmed to do things because of the lack of control we feel about our own lives.
Oh, yeah.
So we look at that and we go, God, you know, I told myself I wasn't going to eat another bowl of ice cream, and I did anyway, as if I'm programmed like a machine, you know, as if I don't have any control.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's part of why they're so fascinating. It's really this, we want to have free will, but we're not 100% sure we do.
Yeah.
Because there's so much even within ourselves that we don't have control over. So that's one thing. And then, so then what was the other thing? Oh, tech workers and love. Yeah, every once in a while, this is sort of a long-term project of mine. I'll host retreats or I'll do workshops because I live near Silicon Valley and I do a lot of talks there because my work is of interest down there. I live a little north of there, about 2 hours north. So I recognize that every time I go there to give a talk or interact with people or have a meeting, there's so much incredible anxiety. And when I have one-on-one sort of sessions with people about what's going on for them in their lives, just because I'm curious, you know, have lunch with them or whatever, almost all of them say the same thing, which is, you know, I'm just not sure I'm okay. Basically, I just want to feel okay. Like, I want to feel like I'm okay. Like, there's a ton of anxiety about there's something wrong with me, I'm not okay. And that's when I started realizing that something that's missing there is there's this desire to like fix the world. Every tech startup seems to have this desire, like, oh, I'm going to fix the world with this app, or I'm going to do, you know, use this app to, you know, make great change in the world. And it's coming from people who often don't feel okay themselves. And so you can see why they want to change the world is they're pretty uncomfortable. And so I've started thinking, okay, they need to hear about love. They need to get that there's this resource called unconditional love that they can draw on at any time and they can be okay. So every once in a while I'll do workshop or retreat or something just to talk to people about that. So that's what that's about. And that's kind of like an ongoing project because it's not like it'll get finished tomorrow. But
Well, but it also, again, goes back to that whole aspect that these people, they come to you because they want to have this in their lives. And to that end, do you think that maybe they would have gone into this particular industry if they'd had that component?
I think people have complex things that dictate their behavior, but I think that is a component. And I think that's part of why I think that's part of why anyone does what they do. If part of your mission is to help save the world, it's often, in fact, I've never seen it not the case, and it's certainly the case in me, that at least originally arises from the feeling of, like, I'm not okay, and the world's not okay, and I'm going to save the world, and as a result, I'm going to save me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's fine. Like, yeah. If that's what motivates people, great.
I think it's kind of clear how this is different. But what I find fascinating is how people are really bent out of shape about, for example, back in the 50s, and back to movies, but not one specific, when the movie industry was caught subliminally advertising on the 24th frame of every 24th frame of a movie to try to get them to go get popcorn or soda or whatever it was that they were trying to sell at the concession stand or whatever it is they were trying to sell. And I don't see that is any different than the what came out of the 2016 election as far as, for example, Facebook is concerned, and the algorithms used to generate advertisements that are geared specifically to individuals. And again, an algorithm can do this in milliseconds, so this is not like this is a time-consuming process. Basically, you go through some profile on Facebook, and it analyzes all of their likes and dislikes and preferences and places they've been and on and on and on, and then literally generates an ad that pops up on their screen that is specifically designed to their preferences. I don't see any difference between that and the illegal, what became illegal, practice of putting an advertisement in the every 24th frame of a movie back in the 50s.
Well, I think the difference is that you can get an ad blocker.
Okay.
So, in other words, you know the ad is there. Mm-hmm. And so the difference is you have a little more control, maybe. I mean, I'm not saying it's either one is that ethical, but I'm saying, like, at least with the other one, you have no choice.
Well, but even what we talked about at the front end of the program, how, you know, we're going around and, oh, I bought something on, I bought a hat. And then my very next screen that I go to, I'm going to go to Yahoo News, and they're trying to sell me the very hat I just bought.
Yeah.
You know.
But that's a, I mean, but you could also not use the internet. You could also, right? I mean, like, if I sit in my house and I'm writing a book on paper or on a typewriter or on my computer without using the internet, I have a choice to not experience that stuff.
Yeah.
And people forget that.
Yeah, they do.
We have to remember that using the internet is a choice, and you're exposing yourself to basically the entire world.
Yeah. Well, it is said that the only unhackable medium is a piece of paper and a pencil or pen.
Yeah.
As long as there isn't a drone with a camera or a satellite with a camera zoomed in on you and what you're doing.
Right. I mean, right. You could be spied on. We could get really paranoid here. But frankly, if my way of dealing with that when I enter that level of paranoia is to say, look, if someone's that interested in what I'm doing, I'm quite flattered.
Well, you know what? I've often said the same thing in reference to when, of course, all these allegations from Mr. Snowden came out about the NSA, you know, and eavesdropping. And for example, you know, we're on Skype, we're on the internet, it's public. If we're being listened to right now, I feel the same way. If my life is that interesting to you who are eavesdropping, hey, I'm flattered that you care that much. But you know what? If my life were a reality TV show, I wouldn't watch it. And it's not that my life isn't interesting to me. But if it were me, you know, trying to find a TV show, I don't watch Big Brother. When it comes on, we change a channel. We hate Big Brother because it's just ridiculous. You know, it's contrived from my perspective. Yeah. But that's another thing. When I went on the internet for the first time in 1994, which seems like a lifetime ago, I said, I no longer have privacy. I accepted that reality. Speaking of realities, I accepted that reality from the get-go.
Yeah.
And then there was another thought that came to me, but this goes all the way back to my early days in broadcasting at a Christian radio station and all the whole aspects of God being omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. I thought, you know, if God knows everything about me, all my pluses and my minuses, my light side and my dark side, what difference does it make if, at the present day, it's 7.6 billion people? What difference does it make if they all know? And most of them don't even care because they're too darn busy just surviving to care about little old Richard Dugan over here in Santa Barbara, California, doing whatever it is that he's doing. And I just kind of gave up that mental aspect of privacy. And then when you go to the spiritual realm, those constructs of liberty and freedom and privacy, they're illusions. They don't exist. That's in my mindset. It's not about that. And that's the interesting thing about us as human beings versus us as spiritual beings.
Yeah, right, right. Privacy, I mean, privacy, right, privacy matters to the ego, right? Which is the part that says, like, look, I did this and I did that and this is mine. And I'm not saying that's incorrect. Like, it's important as a human being to have a sense of self and have an ego that's functioning. But losing privacy is a blow to the ego. If we were all totally sort of enlightened beings and surpassed our ego and were self-transcendent, we'd be have a very different world, but we're not like that.
Yeah.
So sort of like privacy matters psychologically because we're not like that. And once we get to the point that we are all, if we ever get to the point where we're all like that, I don't know if we will, but if we ever did, then there won't be an issue with privacy because no one would even have the urge to spy on anything else, anyone else. Why would that be at all beneficial?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of funny. It's like a catch-22.
It is. I've often said this, especially about, and this was during the Cold War particularly, but even to this day, I have used this phrase when it comes to governments and spies and secrets and all of that stuff, you know? If you have no secrets to keep, then you have no secrets to keep. And you, Julia, and I, Richard, we have had different experiences, but we have had similar, say, internal. I mean, we both experienced love and hate and greed and avarice and all of the different, shall we say, the seven deadly sins, so to speak. But in terms of emotional experiences, we've both had those things in our lives. Our stories are different.
Yeah.
But we've all had those same internal events going on in our lives, so it's like, okay, I empathize and I sympathize with your story and what happened to you. And I can relate because this is what happened to me. And so now we create a connection. We create a bond. We start to then generate sort of a community, similar to, and unfortunately it goes this way, similar to, for example, the Me Too movement and Enough is Enough movement and all of these different groups and organizations that come up. Before we wrap up the program, I want to ask you about the call.
By the way, I agree with you, just so you know. That makes sense to me. Stories don't connect us as much as our deeper experience.
Yeah. Talk to us about the calling.
Wow, I love how you just really did your research. My goodness. Thank you. I'm flattered. The Calling is another book that I'm putting out through a much smaller press than Premonition Code. So it's a book that is coming out through New Harbinger, which is a really wonderful press out in Oakland, and they do a lot of books that cross the line between science and spirituality. And The Calling is about a 12-week program to finding your soul's work and really fulfilling it in the world. Doesn't mean in 12 weeks it'll be fulfilled, but it means in 12 weeks you'll have a plan and you'll be starting to get going on how to fulfill it. And it comes from the world of science in terms of how what I know about how science is done and what we've learned about how humans work, but also it comes from a lifetime habit I have of when I talk with people, I kind of interview them about what their calling is. So, for instance, I would love to ask you some questions about your calling if you're willing.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll do it. I'll do the interview. I ask 5 questions. I don't know if we have time, but I'd like to ask you that because these are the questions I ask people. And the book, the direction of the book came from people's answers to those 5 questions.
Sure.
Okay. So the questions are, what do you think, just really quickly, what do you think a calling is? Like, how would you define that?
A vocation, something that you do and can describe it as being in the zone. If you know that familiar feeling, time has no, you don't have a concept of time because you're so into what you're doing and it just feels right. You're like in the right place at the right time.
Okay, great. So it feels like it flowed and you're there and it's it feels perfect.
There's no resistance.
There's no resistance.
It's just a flow. Yeah, you're right.
Okay. No, you're right. It was your definition. It was great. Okay, so when was the earliest time in your life that you felt, you don't have to say in words what your calling is yet, right? But I'm just asking, when was the earliest time in your life that you felt a hint of, whoa, there's something here for me. This is exciting to me. This is like it lit up for you as something.
I'm going to say it was an experience I had in my childhood when I actually had this dream where I was pedaling. I wasn't on anything. I was pedaling like on a bicycle, and I began to rise up into the sky. And it just felt right. I mean, it just and I've always been intrigued by the concept of, wanting to fly. And I've been lucky enough, I don't have a pilot's license or anything, but I've flown with a number of people in small planes. Love doing that. Love flying in jets from place to place. I love that. So I would say that that was probably my earliest experience, and it was because it's like, wow, this is cool, and this could happen. I could do this if I just start pedaling in my feet, But it just seemed right. And throughout my career, as it were, I have felt from the age of 19 that I've been in the right place at the right time.
Okay, so how old were you when you had that floating up dream?
I'm going to say probably it was 7 or 8.
Okay, cool. All right, next question. In a few words, what do you think your calling is?
In general, to serve, but more specifically, what I am doing now with you, and that is to draw out information for others to hear and recognize that they too can make a difference in the world to make this a better place. That we're looking for those new ways of living because the old ways don't work. All you have to do is look around you. And I think that that's, and in sort of in a broader sense, to change the world, to make this place better for everyone so that nobody is left out, nobody is marginalized. And I don't see why that can't happen. I believe that it can. I don't see why anybody should resist wanting everyone to live their full potential.
Excellent. Okay, so that sounds great. And when you feel like you're off track of your calling, when you feel like something doesn't feel right, I'm not quite doing my thing, how do you get back on track?
Sometimes it's a matter of waiting. Just waiting for that phase to pass. Nothing, I believe that nothing is permanent. No illness is permanent, no dis-ease is permanent, no job is permanent, no relationship is permanent. And then my second relationship marriage, my second marriage anyway, so that helps. But that everything is in flux and everything is in motion, it's moving, and that if I just stay calm, don't get caught up in the trauma drama of whatever it is or the fear, what have you, and just wait it out. Things are going to change because they always do, and I'll be back into that space that feels right for me, and I'm back on track, and that's kind of how I look at that. It's just being patient and waiting. And sometimes that's not easy, but that seems to me to be the best way of doing things.
So you kind of give yourself a pep talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's how you get back on track. And then if this is the last question, if you go back to that 7-year-old self, let's say you have your current everything you know now as a grown-up Richard, and you go back to your 7-year-old self who wakes up from that dream, and you're standing there kindly looking down on yourself, waking up in bed, what would you say to yourself?
Oh, wow. Hang in there because the period of being bullied in school is temporary. And
Awesome.
you'll be out of it soon enough and off on a one amazing adventure.
Perfect. So I ask those five questions to a bunch of people throughout my life, and from sort of noticing their answers and some clarity around that, that's where I wrote The Calling. That's how I came to write the program. That's The Calling, is about those kind of responses. Your responses are so great.
That's very cool. That's very cool. I want to
Cool.
thank you so much for joining us here on the program. I wish we had more time, and I want to have you back again to just continue this conversation that sort of, on the one hand, it goes all over the road, but by the same token, we have a very, it's kind of like the 405, okay? We have a lot of lanes that we can choose from to go into. So it can be a lot of fun. I'd love to have you back. And also, since you do live in California, and even if you didn't, we'd love to have you come down to Santa Barbara and in studio to continue this conversation. I think, because that's one of my preferences. The top preference is to have face-to-face interviews. And if that were to happen, that'd be terrific.
Well, I'll be in Santa Barbara in December.
Hey.
So, I'm giving a talk to the consciousness hacking community on December 9th. So maybe we could schedule something. That'd be fun.
As a matter of fact, we might want to schedule something so that maybe we could have it around that time and even promote it.
Oh, fun.
All
Yeah,
right.
cool. A
Terrific.
great idea.
And
Okay,
also,
thanks so much.
before I let you go, which
Yeah.
website would you, the primary website that you'd want to send people to?
Mossbridgeinstitute.com.
Mossbridge Institute. We will be linked to it, folks. Mossbridgeinstitute.com. That's the website. And now I have three final questions for you. And
Okay.
the first is, who is Julia Mossbridge?
You want me to describe myself, huh?
Whatever
Okay.
answer comes is the answer you give.
Okay. I'm just a person who loves to explore the world, and I've been doing so since I was a kid. And I use science and I use connection with God to help me do that.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
What I hope to achieve through the work I'm doing now is to continue being in relationship with the universe and finding out where it leads me.
And what is your life's purpose?
Oh, my life's purpose is to teach and learn about love and time.
Dr. Julia Mossbridge, again, thank you so much for joining us on the program. This has just been a great pleasure, and we will have you back. If not before, we'll have you back in December when you're here in Santa Barbara.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. It's been really, really, really fun.
I've enjoyed it myself. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.